you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have John Bruce Leonard back on the show. Of course, John is the editor of Arctos Media. He is also the author of a book, The New Prometheans. I guess I describe it as sort of it's a manifesto for the new writer. Your personal manifesto? How would you describe it?
Oh, that sounds like a perfectly reasonable description. Absolutely, Tim.
Okay, because it read like a manifesto. The new right and sort of this closing of an era, almost a half a millennium, 500 years now, you sort of the end of liberalism, the sort of the twilight of the Enlightenment age. Maybe it's a reductio ad absurdum, you could say.
I think that might be nearer the truth, isn't it?
In all things political, cultural, I just read an article today that the New York Yankees hired a female batting instructor.
Why wouldn't they?
So the Bronx Bombers are being instructed by
there's a new one every day there in the States, isn't there?
And I don't know, sports is trivial, but it isn't trivial because it's the popular culture. I mean, if you look at fashion and just public, how people look today, has someone's been guided by sports? Look at like the prevalence of tattoos and body art.
Right.
Sports has led the way with that. So it's really, really, it's trivial, but it really isn't. I just look at these things and what they're doing, you know, it's breads and circuses and social engineering. But anyway, the New Prometheans. What is this book about, and what motivated you to write it?
So I like your description of it as a manifesto. I think that that's actually very appropriate insofar as I'm attempting with this book to lay out some of the earliest possible groundwork of what might become a philosophy of the new right. The premise of this book, which of course will not be unfamiliar to any of your listeners, is that we're living in a time of crisis. That's the presupposition of this book. I think we've really come to such a point now that it's useless to even attempt to demonstrate such a thing. We're all perfectly aware of it. And I believe that this is a universal feeling to some extent or another. It manifests in different ways in different people. People have different interpretations of it, but all of us feel to some extent that we're living in a time of crisis. There's something in the underworkings beneath us that's not quite stable. It's not quite right. So as that, taking that as my presupposition for this book, obviously a number of questions follow from that. First of all, how did we get here? Why are we in this condition? And then what do we do now? How do we move forward from this crisis? Crisis is characterized, in my view, by a number of peculiarities, one of these being that you cannot resolve a crisis by dwelling within the crisis. You have got to break free of it somehow. And so the question, of course, becomes how do we get out of it? How do we get to a perspective, to a higher ground from which we can visualize our condition, visualize our circumstances, and understand exactly what's happened to us, so that we can begin to think of a positive way forward rather than simply falling back into the very easy critiques and recriminations and accusations that we certainly need to be bringing up against our modern society, but which are not sufficient to get us out of this slow creeping nightmare into which we are gradually falling. And so that's kind of the general premise of the book. One of the ways in which I believe this crisis manifests itself most clearly is in the breakdown of the political language that we use today. So, for example, the left-right distinction, which has been pretty much a go-to binary now for easily 100 years and probably longer than that. It emerged in the French Revolution, and it can be traced back, in my opinion, to the Enlightenment itself. It's a very much an Enlightenment dichotomy. This view no longer holds good in the way that it did 50 years ago, which is to say that today there are a number of problems with this view. The conservatives, for example, have failed completely to conserve anything, and so there's obviously a weakness inherent in that idea of the political right as it's been established for several hundred years. But more than that, there are also a number of viewpoints or movements, or in some cases even something approaching worldviews, that move beyond this binary and attempt to find ways of understanding politics from a point of view which is not acceptable either to the conventional left or to the conventional right. In some cases, they take features of both of these things and seem to mix them, in some cases more or less haphazardly, but in other cases, there's a real logic to it. And this shows that the political thinking that we've been living under is no longer sufficient to understanding the political scenarios that are presented to us. We cannot use it, we cannot presuppose it as we once could. And this, to my mind, is a very clear symptom of the crisis in which we find ourselves, and it leads us into an investigation of what exactly it means to speak of the right. In my view, the right cannot be understood as simply half of a singular political spectrum, but I believe that the word itself is very indicative. It's connected to many things beyond simply the political right. There's also a sense of right in the terms of justice. There's a sense of right in the terms of morality. There's a sense of right as well, just in the sense of rectitude, a straight line. And all of these things contribute to making the right, in my view, a very useful way of approaching political things.
Yeah, you mentioned that even someone as ancient as Edmund Burke fit well within the liberal or Enlightenment tradition, his critique. Goes, think of Edmund Burke and his reflections on the revolution in France. And this was sort of the basis of conservative opposition to this, to modernity, you know, the early stages of modernity. But nevertheless, as you mentioned, the conservatives have failed to conserve anything. And you know, we think of William F. Buckley. You refer to his famous remark, yelling "Stop!" at history, standing athwart to history and yelling "Stop!" You know, but again, is an acceptance of the Enlightenment ideas, which I guess from your book, you see them as just fatally flawed. It's something that really you can't make an accommodation with. You have to, and ultimately to, we reach the stage where we are now, you know, coming to an accommodation where they're accepting it part way simply isn't good enough.
This gets back to what you were saying about the present moment being a reductio ad absurdum, a reduction to the absurd of these views that have informed us for the past five centuries. And I do think that when we speak of modernity, obviously there are a number of differing currents within modernity. It's very difficult to reduce all of that to a single viewpoint. But I do think that the Enlightenment is, in a certain sense, the beating heart of the modern worldview and of the modern project. And to my mind, the Enlightenment is fatally flawed. There is no way of establishing Enlightenment ideals on Earth in the fashion that their proponents believed we should be attempting to do. Any attempt to form an Enlightenment society will inevitably lead to something else, because these are not ideals that are fit to human beings. They are generally rationalistic, they are generally scientific. They exclude as much as they include of the human being, in my opinion. And what's more, I believe they exclude the most important part of the human being and of human life, which is to say the spiritual, you know, the aspect which transcends this merely physical plane. And I think that this failing of the Enlightenment can be seen across the board. This is something we clearly are seeing on the level of society and culture and all of the absurdities and the monstrosities which are issuing from these attempts to socially engineer human beings and to make them into some kind of, cosmopolitan consumeristic creatures that are only interested in their work and money, and then they have this really bizarre idea of personal identity, which is completely hollow and meaningless. It can be seen on the political level. So again, with the collapse of the conservative right, the movement of the traditional left more and more toward radicalization and extreme views, and in some ways even a kind of realization in a different form of Marxist or communist views. And it can be seen even, in my opinion, in science, although this is something I don't talk about to a great extent in the book. But I do believe that the borders, the boundaries of science, the natural boundaries in which science is able to perform, are becoming more and more clear. There's a way in which science cannot extend itself to the whole of the universe. It is very effective within a given sphere of understanding, but it can't break out of that because it's basic presuppositions forbid it to do so. And there are a number of ways in which that's showing now. So overall, I would say that the Enlightenment has been a practical failure, which I think is less important, however, than the failure of principle that it represents.
But we've been taught that since the Enlightenment, and this is sort of the Whig view of history that you refer to in the book, is inevitable progress. And this is sort of an attempt to justify the past as opposed to bring about the future, because it gives the regime, if you will, you know, the globalist regime we live under today, it lends it its legitimacy, because we're just mankind is inevitably progressing forward, ever changing, and at the same time they've besmirched or they've slandered the past, you know, the idea of the Dark Ages, right? Or the idea
exactly.
That prior to Enlightenment, it was all in slavery. There's nothing really to admire, despite the architecture and the philosophy, you know. But everything since the Enlightenment, every since the French Revolution, is progressive. Everything before that's backward.
Yes, exactly. And this produces a kind of really interesting dynamic with respect to, you know, historical ideas. History as a concept, this is something I point out in the book. History as a concept is very much a modern concept. The idea of history as we understand it, being that is a kind of progressive development or an unfolding of some kind of internal dynamic, which may be perfectly rational and crystalline, or maybe very mysterious and dark, as, for example, Heidegger believed. But this idea of history is very much a modern idea. And it's a strange idea because it seems to be so obsessed with the past insofar as it seems to be referring constantly to the past. And yet it almost puts up a wall between us and the past. It sets up this kind of a view from which we are unable to see any of the virtues of the past. We are unable to see the ways in which, in many cases, the past is much superior to the present moment. In practically every way, I would maintain, save perhaps a kind of superficially technological one. And so, as you say, there's a kind of contempt for the past inbuilt into this idea of history, because the past is seen to be simply this slow attempt to arrive at the present. And at the same time, there's an equal contempt for the future, and for the same reason. We hear talk of the end of history, and this idea necessarily means that things have to stay the same. They have to be how they are now, which is not, of course, to say that, you know, social justice won't continue to spread its lovely wings across the entirety of society, and people won't become ever more tolerant and ever more accepting, etc., etc. But the basic structure of the political views that we live under, the basic philosophy in which we exist, has to continue if we're living in the end of history, because anything else would represent, obviously, a decline, a kind of retrogression. And this is, I think, a large part of the reason for the extreme intolerance that is seen on the part of these individuals and their inability to accept any kind of critical ideas regarding their own views.
And it's odd because not when you look at history, not history as, you know, a force or a spirit like Hegel or like a science, as Lenin would say, just as things happened. For most of modern history, I mean, meaning going recorded history, European history, let's say going back to, you know, the first 1500 years, say since the birth of Christ up until the Reformation, Europe was very illiberal. Yet it progressed, right. And there was great, it flourished under the idea that the concept of the faith was Europe and Europe was the faith, and this was very completely different than the type of presuppositions we operate under today. Even today's Pope, embraces liberalism. He embraces separation of church and state, which is a contradiction of the doctrine of the church that he leads. but again, everyone's
just stunning.
Oh, you talk about in the book The Enlightenment how the entire world has fallen under its teachings, liberalism. This is the virus that has taken over the software. Now this is the default setting of the modern world. Are these ideas? But if you look at history going further back, even a mere 500 years, but before that there was 1500 years of something completely different.
Yeah, right, exactly. And another many thousand years before that, to extend all the way into a kind of the dim-lit prehistory of the world, which I think is probably not at all what we're taught it is. I think there's probably a lot more to it than we fancy from our historicist perspective, which likes to see everything coming out of this kind of evolutionary milieu and these sorts of primitive people crawling out of caves and building straw huts or whatever it was they did. But right, exactly right. I think that's very true, Tim. And I think that the contradictions that are inherent to the Enlightenment are already present in that remark that right now we're living under thoroughly Enlightenment views, because obviously the kind of society that we're living under today is not exactly what the Enlightenment forefathers would have had in mind. In some ways, superficially, I think they probably, just being as they were from a gentlemanly class, most of them, I think they would probably find many of the moral turns that have recently afflicted us rather horrific. But there's also this way in which the society that they foresaw and that they envisioned is not possible in the world. This kind of society of which perfectly balances liberty and equality to the extent that every human being is equal before the law, and every human being is endowed with an equal amount of liberty. This is an impossibility. I have a couple of chapters dedicated in the book to this point, that there's a tension between these two things. You cannot have a perfectly equal society that's at the same time perfectly free. And part of this is due to the fact that the Enlightenment thinkers, in order to attempt to produce the possibility for the society that they were aiming for, had to change our idea of these concepts. There's a really deep work which is done on the idea of liberty, for example. This is something that is featured in the last chapter of the book. Work on the idea of liberty, dividing it from the idea of virtue, with which it had always been strictly and intimately connected in past times.
Liberty is license, yeah.
Exactly, exactly right. Liberty is license. Liberty to do as one lists. Liberty to determine for oneself one's own personal happiness and to strive to attain it. This is the idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? The libertarians like to point out that it's not a guarantee to happiness, but in my opinion, it's a guarantee to something even more insidious, which is that you, as a sovereign individual, will be able to attain your happiness in your life by your own lights alone. I think it's a very dangerous view from the social point of view, and I think that the contradictions inherent to it are showing forth in the present moment. The Enlightenment cannot continue the way that it was meant to. It cannot arrive at that plateau, that historical plateau that it desired. The true face of the Enlightenment is not at all a luminous one. It is a very dark and frightening one, as we're beginning to see with the emergence of this new, very, very corrupt, even corrupt is even an inadequate word for our ruling class. We're speaking of individuals who in many cases appear to be absolutely soulless. These are just very frightening times from that point of view. And this increasing gulf which stands between the extraordinarily rich and everybody else, and this increasing leverage that's used by that very difference in wealth in order to accommodate the interests of the super wealthy and to force the average individual to become a kind of mindless consumer. And this is the real face of the Enlightenment. It's not at all what the Enlightenment thinkers had in mind. And it proves that there is no end of history, particularly as these kinds of triumphalist thinkers would propose. The end of history is rather simply the slow and increasingly fast-paced, actually, destruction and corruption of everything that we used to call tradition and everything that we used to cleave to in our societies, and its substitution with something which is monstrous and extraordinarily dangerous.
Yeah, you wrote in the book how there was a time when it was presumed in a political state, if you will, the polis, that there was no separation between the religion and the political because they were fused. And, you know, the traditional understanding of this is, the religion is to the state as the soul is to the body.
Right.
And this worked all the way through. And this is inherently hierarchical and illiberal, and there was a lot of prescriptions in these societies. But the irony is, when we're talking about this, people will accuse you again of trying to justify fascism or authoritarianism and control and these words. But if you look at today's liberal society, it is far more proscriptive and prescriptive than any traditional society. And the liberal society doesn't even live up to its own standards. You know, when you take in all the corruption, they give lip service to constitutionalism, the rule of law, and these things. But in anything, the greater, as society gets more progressive and more liberal, it becomes more hierarchical and more intolerant and crueler and oppressive.
That's right. And it's permitted all of this by this kind of facile illusion of human equality, which is something that, you know, people in our day are extremely emphatic about, that all human beings should be equal. And that equality, it's not clear exactly what's meant by it. I mean, there, of course, is this idea of equality before the law, which is even to an extent an old Roman idea. But what's interesting about the contemporary times is that the equality can't remain at that level of equality before the law. It's always pushed beyond because it's combined with democracy and with this constant striving of individuals for greater wealth, for greater status, for greater this and for greater that. And, it's a society founded on bribery, essentially, isn't it? On this just continual paying off of pretty much everyone in order to convince them that they really are better off than they used to be and that they're moving up in the world and all manner of things like this. And I think that there is a way in which this is a kind of religious view. I mean, it's not religious in any kind of legitimately religious sense, but it's religious insofar as it's taken to be an article of faith now, that democracy, for example, is good. That liberalism is good, that these social orders are the ones that should be preserved and continued and extended to all of the world. And you can see the ways in which the old religious functions are being filled these days by secular functionaries. People have a similar response to science, for example, and to scientific research as they used to have to the statements of the church on given, you know, on issues like diet or how to live one's life or social relations, things of this sort. The needs that are at the basis of human society haven't changed. They've just been perverted and redirected into false ends. And so this is one of the reasons I think it's so important to try to break out of all of these false binaries that are presented to us by our contemporary world. You pointed to one of these when you were talking about the way in which religion used to be necessarily connected to the state. There wasn't the same kind of clear division between religion and politics that we see today. That's not to say, of course, that there weren't at times tensions between the two. That's not to say that there weren't different functions ascribed to each in different parts of the West in different historical eras. But there was an interpenetration of the two. It was understood that you could not speak of politics without speaking of God, that you could not do certain things without the favor of, say, the Pope. Nowadays, we have this idea of theocracy, which is, in my opinion, one of these convenient modern concepts that lets us just completely avoid the issue altogether by presuming that there's a specific kind of state in which religious authority is enshrined. In all past societies, that was not the case. All past societies had this kind of interpenetration. You could not speak meaningfully of a theocracy in past societies.
Yeah. The secular state itself creates its own religion.
Right.
Its own rites. And, we put judges in robes. and they read the bird in
scientists
barrels.
Too.
That's right. Special. Scientists in white, the white jacket has replaced the vestments, of the traditional rite and these things. And they pronounce from on high. Just check out whenever a president, a former president dies, look at the funeral. It's like it'd make a pharaoh blush.
Right.
But the state has to. The state always resorts to some sort of religious belief in its legitimacy, and of course the modern state without God has no legitimacy, whereas past states could claim divine right or some connection to God. So it just doesn't change. It's just like when you talk about tolerance and pluralism, and this, and in order to tolerate these things you must have what was called the naked public square, but there's no such thing, because then the values of secular humanism fill the vacuum, and those become the reigning ideas. And then even ideas of society has this idea of deviance, and now we have a new form of deviance. And so this idea of toleration in liberalism again is another it's another lie. It's an illusion. It's a mirage. It doesn't exist, because everyone has to. There's always some group that wants to, or some idea or some notion of right and wrong that imposes itself. Otherwise, you can't have a functioning society in one direction or the other.
Exactly right. And we are facing this. There's an alternative to my mind confronting the idea of the virtue of tolerance in our day. Either this tolerance comes to the point where it accepts intolerant attitudes for what they are and permits them to continue to be intolerant, or else it will become intolerant of intolerant attitudes, which means being intolerant of everything except for liberalism, conveniently, right? It's an attempt to change the entire world into a liberal attitude. One way or another, though, it's bound to fall apart. It's bound to come apart at the seams. It cannot continue on these premises. What I think we're seeing right now is that historical moment at which this kind of superficially rationalistic philosophy of the Enlightenment has arrived at a point where its rationality can no longer guide it. It cannot produce a rational society, and the attempts to do so demonstrate the limits of that attempt. It demonstrates that there's a point at which that falls apart, because you are confronted with human nature, which is not simply rational. It is both also, and it has elements which are both sub-rational and also super-rational. And you cannot account for those in a rationalistic society. What happens at a point like that is what happens whenever a philosophy runs aground of reality. It has to resort to brute force. And we're going to be seeing more and more of that, I'm afraid, as we continue. We're going to be seeing more of this kind of actually implemented intolerance against alternative views, this attempt to produce a kind of homogeneity of opinion, and this attempt to consolidate the power that's been centralizing more and more in these, again, these super rich, super political figures who exist kind of behind the scenes or above the scenes. They're very much cosmopolitan individuals. They don't have any real home city or base. And I think that more and more we're going to be seeing the necessary consequences of all of these artificial attempts.
This is why they themselves, these are they run the corporations which promote so much of the neoliberal global homo agenda, is because this is sort of more or less a business plan, because they.
Right.
They can by creating by going after destabilizing societies and creating massive population shifts, mass migration, you assault tradition, you knock down the barriers, the firewalls to sort of global homogeneity. And again, it's mass capitalism, mass consumption, and they have at their disposal all the political and financial power of the world to do this, because it's all done under the name of diversity and democracy. They, and so it's these are the justifications for these various policies, whether it's fomenting a war here or a revolution there, a coup there, or NGOs, you know, subsidizing or financing mass migration, you know, from an entire subcontinent into the northern areas or from the Middle East into Europe. They've openly talked about, you know, how, you know, the ethnic states of Europe need to go away and you need to import.
Yes, yes.
You know. And at the same time, they're promoting the global homo agenda, which results in lower birth rates, depopulation. Then they turn around and say, now you need to import cheap labor from Africa or from Latin America or from Asia. And again, this is a war on tradition, a war on integral societies, and they can't stand integralism or anything approaching that because they need constant flux and change. That's how you create a sort of a deracinated, atomized mass. In the name of tolerance, they make everything a dull gray. That's the funny thing. They talk about rainbows and stuff, but they're turning it into a dull gray. You know, it's yeah.
This is something I've long observed in the United States. There is, in the United States, a kind of outward diversity of dress, at least in some cases. You might find people who are, you probably find more eccentrically dressed people in the United States than in other countries of the world, things of this sort. But you recognize that this kind of diversity, what you see there is simply skin deep. Because the moment you talk to these people, you recognize that the dogmas to which they subscribe are identical to those to which everyone else subscribes. There's a real homogeneity of opinion there, which I think indicates, once again, the falsity of these attempts and the impossibility of actually implementing them in any kind of real or authentic way, which leads naturally to their perversion and their twisting at the hands of individuals who are willing to break rules in order to get what they want. Like these plutocrats under whose rule, unfortunately, we're presently suffering.
Yeah, and they're the ones. I mean, yeah, again, you know, the George Soros types. We can name names. Open society, the NGOs, you know, the banking families. And of course, he's an agent of the Rothschild. And you know, I think someone referred to them as sort of the vampire squid. Sucking the face of humanity. I think it was Matt Tiavi at Rolling Stone, but that's a, I think an apt fair description. But you talk about the new right, and you have this vision. So this is our present crisis, the closing of an era, the modern era, the reduction ad absurdum of liberalism or the Enlightenment, and so. We're at a moment of crisis, and a crisis can mean, you know, a time of turmoil and trouble. It's also a moment of opportunity, if I understand the true meaning of it.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
And
exactly
so you talk right. About the new right, European man, Occidental man, Western man. Who exactly is he? What can he be?
Right. I mean, that's the real question I think that's confronting us. Is it possible for us to come back out of this darkness into which we are descending? And how do we do that? And I think that the idea of, you know, as I call them, Occidental man in this book, might be one way in which we're able to come out, because it's an idea which connects us necessarily back to our historical roots. It connects us to the past, which helps us to avoid another one of the real dangers, I think, of times of crisis, and that is a kind of fervent revolutionary attitude which wants the new for the sake of the new. This is what caused, for example, the collapse in Russia of the old Tsarist regime, I think. The ability that the communists had to infiltrate society and to produce a revolution there, because that was also a moment of crisis so far as the regime was concerned, and so far as the old ways were concerned. And it opened up the possibility for this kind of radically revolutionary, thoroughly secularized and atheistic regime to come into existence. What we have to perceive, I think, is that exactly as you said, Tim, we're living at a moment in which the dangers that are confronting us are as potent as the possibilities which are confronting us. It's difficult to see that because we are living at a moment in which all of this is coming to a head. And, I mean, you pointed out of the enormous wealth, influence, and power that's wielded by these individuals, which, of course, is very disheartening because we're speaking of something that we cannot even dream of coming near to challenging in any kind of practical or material sense. But the fact that we are living in a society whose basic premises can no longer be supported by the manifestations of the social order itself will produce necessarily unrest, unease, potentially also some very hard times. I mean, it is entirely possible that we'll see the falling apart of European states or something like this in the not-too-distant future, as much as I actually hope that doesn't happen, because that kind of catastrophe is never to be wished for. But nonetheless, moments like this, in my opinion, open up possibilities that cannot exist in times of tranquility in which everyone is content to live within a kind of dogmatic bubble, and they don't have to confront in any way the problems that are inherent in every individual human worldview. There are always contradictions in individual philosophies of the world, let's say, individual outlooks of the world is a better way of putting it. There are always contradictions inherent to that. Most of the time, people are able to avoid those contradictions. Times of crisis force them to face these contradictions because the contradictions come to the surface, become real, become evident, they incarnate in the world around us, and they cause trouble, almost as if they were, you know, deep forces that were hiding beneath the surface and just waiting to break out. Our demons are coming home, these demons that we've been summoning now for centuries. In moments like that, though, we cannot be sure what tomorrow is going to hold. We cannot be sure that there will not come a moment in the very near future in which possibilities that seem to us now absolutely unfeasible and unimaginable really do open up as real possibilities. They become things that we can actually work toward and attain. Things are moving very, very swiftly, ever faster, and I think that's another characteristic of our times. I don't think it's going to slow down. I think the contrary is probably true. Things are going to grow yet swifter, and the changes that are circling us will likewise speed up to an extent that it will be very, very difficult to follow them. It's already impossible to follow just the course of the news of a single nation, not to speak of the entire West. But the consequences of that as well are that the future is utterly unpredictable. We have no idea what's going to happen. We have no idea what tomorrow is going to look like. And I think that that's why it is of the essence now that we begin to look at the question of personal virtue, of preparing ourselves on the personal level. And this in all ways. I mean, not simply in the production of a kind of moral being, although obviously that as well, but also in the perfection of our inner man as much as we possibly can, the perfection of our practical skills in preparation for possible times of trouble. All of these things are important right now because the face of tomorrow will be built by the kinds of characters that we are able to produce in the meantime.
Yeah, the model for this is, of course, spread of Christianity in the first three centuries.
Yes, exactly. That's an excellent model.
The willingness to martyr, the martyrdom, also the willingness to be martyred, and also personal virtue is what converted so many people and ultimately led to the conversion of the Roman Empire. Whether Constantine's decision was cynical or not, he realized there was the political advantage to recognizing Christianity. So it was centuries of evangelization that led to that and created, you know, Europe itself, Christendom.
And think of how unlikely that was, absolutely impossible that must have seemed from the point of view of anybody living at the time of the early Christians.
Mm-hmm. So it is something about, you know, the idea of practicing denial or some form of asceticism and the willingness to take a risk and also to be a target, to be martyred for these things, and not to make a fetish out of it.
No, indeed. And there does exist that fetish, unfortunately.
But there's everyday martyrdom that the person can experience when they're confronted at work. It's something is said or done, and you can make a statement, or either by your words or by your behavior that may have an impact, and the cumulative effect of everyone doing that will have a profound effect in society in the fullness of time. That's what we have to look for. We're not given to know these things. It's vanity to expect that we'll have the revolution overnight and everything will be fine. Indeed. It's not the way that the world works. And this isn't to say that day in and day out there won't be, you know, joy and pleasure and also pain. It's life. The ability to strengthen yourself and prepare, and also recognize that there is indeed a problem, as opposed to just right. The Benedict option, where you just hide away and hope they ignore you, or you just say, well, everything's okay, fine with me right now. I'm not gonna get into these things. I can't make a difference. That sort of attitude.
Right.
This idea of consciousness, which I think is part of this the crisis that the global elite are facing now. This is with the internet, something they created for control, has sort of come back to bite them. This thing, the ability that I can have this conversation with you, and you're living on some rock in the middle of the Mediterranean, and I'm on the East Coast of the United States, and here we are talking, and then you know, there'll be literally hundreds of people listening to me at some point.
It's all very strange.
There was a time when, I could talk, but it could only be to a mirror. Now I can talk, and so it gets out. So that's an important thing. But nevertheless, idea of E. Michael Jones is the concept of logos rising, and he's written, he did his part about writing books about libido dominandi, as sexual liberation, as political control, as psychological warfare. And that's had a profound effect, I think, on millions of people in recognizing the effect of pornography and sexual liberation has.
Right.
And who's, probably he didn't know he was going to make, when he was fired from his job at the university back in the late 70s, he didn't know he was going to have this impact. And he's receiving some attention now in his eighth decade of life. And this is how, you got to be patient sometimes, I suppose. But he made a point, just this idea of consciousness. And he gave an account where he was, I think, touring Poland. And this was for his book, The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, I believe. And the usual suspects came out and tried to put pressure on the Catholic Church in Poland to cancel his speech.
How absolutely unexpected.
But in Poland, where there's strong ethnic and religious consciousness, the church is strong. The church said, don't worry. And he was able to deliver speech and, push his books and his ideas. And as a result, Poland has yet to fall fully under the foot of liberalism. They rejected gay marriage. And although there is still a strong effort there to subvert Polish society, there's a lot of pushback, much more pushback in the East than there is in the corrupt West of these things, because these societies have maintained their integralism. Ironically, somewhat because of the Berlin Wall and these things. That's but so there is hope, and there is ground that you can stand on and fight back if you have the courage and the consciousness to do so.
And I believe that all of us can do so in one way or another. I mean, I am not a proponent necessarily of every individual going out and simply, declaiming their personal views from the rooftops or anything like that. I think that would probably be more destructive than anything else. Although, I don't know, it's difficult to imagine even such a thing. But obviously, every individual has a personal situation that he has to come to terms with. There are legitimate reasons for some people to be a little bit quieter than other people, or mm-hmm. to work anonymously on these things. But I think what is absolutely fundamental in all cases is the development of this kind of inner integrity of which you were speaking, Tim. This production on a variety of levels of an inner freedom. Coming back to this idea of the Enlightenment and how it distorted many of the fundamental concepts of our Western tradition. The disconnect between freedom and liberty, I think, has been of extraordinary importance, because it's produced this idea of freedom as an external affair only. If you have a given set of laws that do not prescribe your actions too strictly, that permit you to move as you will and to believe as you will and to speak as you will, then you're presumed to be free. This is an absurdity from any kind of older view of freedom. Freedom is something that has to be obtained in an inner sense. Freedom is something that has to be built inside of a human being, and it's something that needs to be attained despite all of the many, many different kinds of slavery that exist in the world. You bringing up pornography is an excellent example. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are countless young men who are enslaved to this beast of pornography because they simply do not have control over themselves adequately enough to break free of it. And that's something that all of us can work on, even privately, and I don't believe that that is of minor importance. I mean, obviously, there's a way in which we also have to be forthright, and we have to speak out when it's possible and defend our views and things of this nature. But if we are not internally liberated in an authentic way, to the extent that we would be free men even if they throw us into a prison, we would still be free men. If we do not have that kind of freedom, I don't think that our outward freedom will avail us.
No, because you can't have have chaos internally and expect the political order that's not be chaotic. And it's I think Burke himself, he said something to the effect that men are predisposed to be free and liberated to the extent that they can exert internal control. And,
right.
And to me, it's self-evident. You gotta be guided by reason in your life, and you gotta control your passions and these things. For everything, there's a season, there's a time for everything, and to be governed by your appetites or your base desires is to be enslaved. As Saint Augustine said, "Man has many masters as he has vices." And we live in a society where there's always someone out there willing to satisfy your vices.
You know, exactly.
I mean, now, the irony is, pornography is now virtually free. And, so ask yourself, we live in a society where everything costs something, yet that is free. So that's
interesting.
They still charge. That's a good point. You still have to pay for to watch football, but you can watch that for free, so this is this thing. I was reading, talk about chaos and order. America has, this it's almost this eternal race problem, particularly with blacks, and it's become more complicated with immigration, but still with blacks. I was reading an article about the Moynihan Report recently. Are you familiar with the Moynihan Report?
I don't actually, Tim. What is it?
Senator Patrick Moynihan. He wrote it when he was an employee for the Department of Transportation for the Johnson administration, and basically it was 1965. It was during the civil rights era when the Civil Rights Acts were being passed, the Voting Rights Act, and this is also the era of the Great Society, and he came up with a plan. Now, Patrick Moynihan himself was Catholic, and he came from a broken family himself, but he knew a lot about Catholic social teachings, particularly regarding the family, and this was when a lot of ideas were being considered for the Great Society and programs. And he was writing at the time about the crisis in the black family because the illegitimacy rate was 21%. 21%. The average illegitimacy rate in the United States now is now approaching 40%. I think it's 25% with white Americans. It's 80% with black Americans.
That's appalling.
Of course, I say if you look at an 80% illegitimacy rate with black Americans, whatever problems they have politically with the civil rights is with that much chaos in their community, they'll never be free, nor they can contribute anything to the political body except be a lumpen proletariat, which I think is what the Great Society intended to create, a lumpen proletariat. They've been a lumpen proletariat for the elite to create problems. That's my view.
Exactly.
Nevertheless, they although I do think they have been victimized by that. But his idea with the Moynihan Report was you have to stabilize the black family to deal with poverty. And he came with a plan like creating postal jobs for black men, and emphasize men, so they could be male. They could be the wage earners for their family, and this would produce stability in the family and solve a lot of the problems that some of the other programs were supposedly designed to deal with. He said you can't solve the poverty problem without stabilizing the black family. The problem with that vision or that idea was that it conflicted with the spirit of the age, the sexual revolution, and the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement was heavily sexually compromised themselves. You heard stories about Martin Luther King and these things, and you hear about what was going on in the South with the women. I think it was Stokely Carmichael, when he was asked, what's the position of women in the civil rights movement? His response was prone. So this was a serious problem. They didn't want to talk about at the time because they thought it might undermine the civil rights movement, some of the sexual behavior of its leaders and what was going on. A lot of liberal white girls are going down south from these things to carry out that revolution. But his idea was you stabilize the black family, but you couldn't stabilize the black family without imposing some idea of traditional Christian sexual morality. And that ran against the spirit of the age and the objective of the state, which was sexual liberation, which was ultimately started to create chaos in the community. But again, you can't solve it. It's just an example of when you have a regime or society that's promoting internal chaos, you can't have a political tranquility. That's a long way. Long-winded way to go about saying that. But that's
these kinds of concrete examples, though, I think are very important because they show the ways in which all of this has unfolded. And the ways in which all of this has been planned as well. I think that the people who are presently in positions of power and in positions of rule are very, very good at taking advantage of situations, as that particular example shows. I mean, the production of a lumpen proletariat out of this hurting community in the United States is clearly been very effective for them in the long run. But I mean, it also shows, I think, the way in which it's very, very important to get some clarity about the ideas and the words that we use. And we are, again, we're living in a time in which everything is changing, and it's changing very, very rapidly. These words that we use are very often built in such a fashion as to lead us into states of confusion, to lead us into states of unclarity, to lead us into states even of slavery in a certain way. I mean, the idea of freedom, again, has been transformed to such an extent that freedom now means embracing your vices, right? That's exactly what it means to be a free human being. You can do whatever you want, and so you just do whatever you want, and that proves that you're free. But obviously, there are subtler forms of slavery that are even promoted by that kind of an attitude. And this is absolutely one of the reasons that the religious attitude is so important for the human being on the social level and on the personal level, because without that kind of a basis, which gives to morality an augustness and a dignity, which it can easily come to lack in a secular state, it's a very simple matter for people to just lose their old sense of right and wrong and to begin to exhibit in their daily existences a sort of fundamental confusion about those things.
Yeah, example of religion. I was reading Charles Colomb's book, Puritan Empire. Mm. It's about Americanism. He's Catholic, and it's right about America sort of as a Freemasonic republic, and inherently there's a conflict between traditional Catholicism and America as she was created. And this is something that Catholics, in trying to become good Americans, have embraced Americanism and also a lot of these Freemasonic principles, when they would have been better to be more traditionally Catholic and try to transform Catholic, American society that way. That's the book. But he was talking, I was reading, and he was talking about how if the liturgical calendar of the traditional Catholic Church, how it gave all these feast days, and how if a Catholic would identify with that calendar more than the society around him, that Catholic will be strengthened to reject sort of the psychological warfare and the bad influence of society around. They basically gives them an identity to relate to other than popular culture and these things, and how, as you see, if people have lost these traditions and these rights, they've become deracinated and atomized, and they, of course, the vacuum there is filled with consumer goods, which is the New World Order is more than happy to provide at interest on credit.
Indeed.
So this is an example again of the function of again have something other to repair to when assaulted, and people are denied that, and they are atomized. And also just the idea of religion maintaining the idea of objective morality, right and wrong. And even at the final analysis, look at today, just sanity. Because we have today, look at the secular modern world today, where now we have this transgenderism and these things, which is just utterly insane, you know.
Right. Completely unimaginable from any kind of prior viewpoint. And it's come about so quickly. I mean, certainly in the course of my life, I've seen these things come to fruition. Obviously, there were tendencies even before I was mm-hmm. born in this direction. But nonetheless, it has become socially acceptable so very fast. And that's another instance of just how quickly things are moving around us. But the religious question, I believe, is absolutely fundamental. I think that, I mean, I believe we discussed this, Tim, as well in our last conversation together, which was actually for Interregnum Arctos podcast. But the way in which the church has been a target of modernity since mm-hmm. the very beginning, it has been loathed by modern figures. It has been the great enemy of the Enlightenment. I mean, it's been a kind of bastion against which they have thrown themselves from the very start. And I think that's very, very telling. Unfortunately, it seems they've made headway in a certain respect. But nonetheless, the church still represents a kind of connection to a very, very long past. You cannot be a Catholic and not have a sense of the past. You cannot be a Catholic, I mean, a real Catholic, I mean, and have a kind of historicist outlook in which everybody was born yesterday as an idiot and we've only just now come into our, you know, our awareness and in our enlightenment. The Catholic Church is one of the few remaining religious institutions that really represents that kind of stability. I think the Eastern Orthodox Church is another one. Most of the Protestant churches, in my opinion, have had their legs cut out from underneath them. And this is just for reasons of the way the structure of Protestantism and its natural tendency to dissolve and fall apart, which is not to say that there aren't, of course, you know, decent and respectable individuals who are Protestants. And it's not to say that Protestantism is not vastly superior to a kind of secularized atheist viewpoint. But I don't believe that there's another institution in the world today that has that same kind of strength to it. And this despite all of the very unfortunate changes that have come about in the church in recent days.
Why it's been so specifically targeted.
Yeah.
And it's why it seems so, I guess, under siege today, as we can see.
That's right.
In the book, you talk about the importance of ethnos, and the race issue, because you bring up the idea of white nationalism that's sort of percolating here in the United States, sort of racial identity, white nationalism, white identity. Of course, that's, you know, largely a reaction to the assault on heritage America, European culture in America, white culture, if you will. Whiteness itself is a product of social engineering, you know, of destruction of ethnic identity, you know, the idea of white Americans. What is right. The white American? And you say, there's a lot of dialogue now going on between, white nationalists and someone like a traditional Catholic, E. Michael Jones, because he talks a lot about the psychological warfare there that had targeted white ethnic groups like Irish Americans, German Americans, Polish Americans, particularly Catholics. But also, he's been very critical in his writings about, you know, the weaponization of civil rights, weaponized migration. He's very aware of the stuff, and he's been dialoguing a lot with white nationalists, talking about what they have in common. And so there's a lot going back and forth. And you kind of touch upon this in this book about how, you know, white identity, it may not be wholly wrong, but it may be necessary, but isn't sufficient. It's a stage, and you can't base the new right identity, the Occidental man, can't be based solely on race, because there's ethnoi and there's culture. Can you want to expand on that?
Absolutely. So the idea of race really became a kind of hot topic with the rise of the alt-right in the United States. Obviously, as you point out, race has been a long-standing problem in the United States. It's one that's never, ever gone away and probably never will, so long as the status quo remains what it is. But it became a political question with the rise of the alt-right, something that people were actually talking about and something that they were attempting to build a new idea on. And I think that there's something, in a certain sense, refreshing about this, insofar as there is simply, on the part of these individuals who see race with such clarity, there is a resistance to the kind of liberalistic dogma that has so infused our societies. Again, this idea of human equality with absolutely no concern for differences between specific human beings, this kind of blanket opposition to discrimination, which, I mean, even the word itself, discrimination, that's actually, once upon a time, was considered a good thing to be a discriminating individual. Now it's...
Yeah, exactly. I know. It's funny. Yeah. Discriminating palate, right?
Exactly. Discriminating palate, right. Yeah. I'm a man of discrimination, right? And now, obviously, it's one of the worst vices possible to a human being. You're a discriminator, right? You discriminate against people. So there is a way in which this growing awareness of racial differences, of the differences also between just very, very large genetic groups, let's say the Africans or the Europeans or the Asiatics or the Jews, et cetera, et cetera. This is a way in which one can begin to break free from the modern closure that has been enforced on us and has been inculcated into us by our educational systems. And it's very effective at doing so precisely because it ties back to science. The idea of race is a scientific idea. It's an idea that can be mathematized. You can put it into numbers. You can point to specific characteristics in human beings, which are rooted in genetics. And so for an age like ours, which is so dependent on the scientific attitude, it becomes a kind of corridor out of which one can begin to escape. One can begin to move away from this kind of excessive modernism. But precisely for that reason, it's not adequate in and of itself, because it is a very materialistic idea. If you limit yourself to a consideration of race and you believe that human beings can be reduced to their genetic component alone, we become automata. We become the puppets of this kind of blind evolutionary urging, which has come through over the course of aeons and aeons. And we are consequently deprived of everything which makes us fundamentally human. This is one of the basic contradictions, I think, at the heart of evolutionary science, that if you follow its conclusions through to the end, you must conclude that human beings are mechanisms which are designed to act in certain ways. There's no such thing as a personal freedom that cannot possibly exist, because we are simply mechanisms. And yet science itself proposes itself as a kind of quest for, if not the truth, then certainly growing comprehension of the universe through the ability to manipulate it. And there's an evident contradiction here. How can a machine do that? Right? I mean, how can it produce this kind of thought? This, I think, is reflected very clearly in the racial question, because if human beings are simply the genetic products of a long evolutionary line, then we are nothing but the kind of blind pawns of a different kind of history, to return to that other very modern concept. We are not beings endowed with a soul or with the ability to perceive the cosmos. We are no longer the microcosmos, to use an old term. You know, we're no longer capable of actually comprehending the ordered whole of the universe. We're simply accidents. And I think that this has implications on all levels of one's view of the world and of other human groups. I think that if you really subscribe to the racial theory and don't see it as just one element of the human being, but as the element of the human being, you'll be led necessarily to the consequence that we should be trying to provide for the good of our genetic group, simply because that's what evolution is about, which is already a very hollow explanation. I mean, it doesn't answer the question why at all. But leaving that aside, we should be doing this simply because this is our kind of evolutionary imperative. And the consequence of that is that we should be doing anything that we can in order to preserve our genetic group. It doesn't matter what the quality of that group is. It doesn't matter what we have to do to preserve it. It's a recipe for a very, very low attitude toward morality, in my opinion, both from the point of view of what it's aiming to preserve and from the point of view of the things that it's quite probably willing to do in order to see to that end.
Yes, the idea, if you you focus solely on race and you deny things like development of personal virtue, you know,
right,
living a decent life, not living a dissolute life, which many do, many don't though. That's kind of a slander I hear. Again, you just reduce everything down to that, then you're not going to solve the problem, the central question of the Enlightenment, which we were talking about earlier. Bad philosophy, right? You don't get to that.
Right.
It's a part of it, not a part of it, because again, we get back to the idea of the ethnoi, this ethnic state, where it's a stable basis for a polity. I guess there was a time when people wouldn't talk about white nationalism, or because it was just presumed if you were part of a political body, you came from the same ethnicity, and that, you know, and so wasn't really discussed or even debated, even thought about much. But what we're seeing now is after so many generations of like social engineering, you know, forced integration, especially here in the United States, we're also seeing in Europe, where, you know, we have Identity Europa, that sort of thing, where you have this emerging consciousness of race in Europe as their mass migration is inflicted upon them. And it does exist counterpoised to, white identity exists in opposition to something. But it doesn't necessarily mean that's wrong, because you have to, I guess a common enemy does help, and it does help form an identity for the moment of crisis. And so it's a question of strategy, not morality, I guess you could say. There is no white race, really. There's Caucasians, I guess, Europeans, that sort of thing. But in the States, it's a different story. And it's kind of a trap, yes, because we're being told that of white privilege, that whites are racist. But then if whites try to coalesce in response to that accusation, we're told that we don't exist.
That's right.
So,
nice.
You know, it's a rhetorical trap. I'm thinking, wait a second. And then, you know, like, cause I've mentioned this in other interviews, I think I mentioned to you, how we read articles written by, you know, academics, law professors about the demographic changes, pretending great political change and culture change, the decline of white America, what will America be like if it's no longer white majority, and these things. So we're told about all these changes that are going to occur. But then again, if I say I don't like those changes, the only way to stop those changes, if it is indeed inevitable, would be to reverse the demographic trends. Just the question is whether or not it is white identity something that one can rest upon, repair to effectively politically in a movement. That's the question.
You know? That is the question. Yeah. And I think one does have to discriminate to a certain extent, to return to that word, between the European situation and the American situation.
Because America is a proposition nation.
Exactly, because America is a proposition nation.
Ideas matter, which I don't think is necessarily true, because if you look at America before, say, the mid-20th century, it was really decentralized. And, you know, basically you didn't have people playing social engineering games and shifting people around and creating a mass migration, these things. So we got more of that in the 20th century. So we created more of a problem. So,
right, as the product of technology and our increasing ability to communicate and to move and to produce, cheap constructions and things like that.
Yeah, the highways and the railroads, you know.
So, exactly, yeah. Exactly. That's right. returning to the question of white identity and its importance or its role, I think that in the context of the United States, it probably makes a degree of sense to speak of it. I think that it's very dangerous for the reasons that I brought up. And I think that it ends up being a kind of last stand of a failing conservatism. In other words, the conservatives, perceiving that they have been completely unable to actually maintain anything in the United States, and that they've been giving ground to the liberals now for who knows how long, when they break free of that paradigm, there's a kind of tendency to say, well, you know, we could actually have a kind of conservative American nation if only we had ethnic homogeneity, if only we were all, you know, white, we had a nice white ethnostate there in the United States, then we could preserve the Constitution, we could continue living in this kind of traditional American way. And I'm dubious about that. I don't think that's true, because I think that even though obviously the lifestyle of the average American 200 years ago, 100 years ago, was much, much healthier than the lifestyle of the average American today, nonetheless, we're seeing right now the sprouting forth of seeds that have been planted for a very long time. And I don't think that one can get away from those. I think that republic necessarily leads to democracy, which necessarily leads to this kind of power vacuum in which malevolent forces will begin to take control. So I think that there is that danger of falling into this kind of a trap of saying we can hold to our own, our old ways, if we just have ethnic homogeneity. Ethnic homogeneity in the United States, of course, means European descent. Mm-hmm. And what's special about the American situation is that there really was a kind of intermixing of all of these European ethnicities. Obviously, there's still historical districts in many cities in the States in which you can find more or less traditional communities of, say, Italians or Irishmen or what have you. But most of the time, these old ethnic, those old European ethnic identities were kind of washed away in a sea of sort of American whiteness, a kind of generic whiteness. And so to that extent, I think that
A lot of Italian guys married Irish girls and vice versa. Yeah,
exactly right. Exactly right. And you hear it every now and then in the surname. You can tell that somebody came from a certain specific heritage, or you can see certain phenotypes that will recall different regions of Europe. But they're all Americans. And so, to that extent, the idea of whiteness actually does have a kind of political sense in the United States that I don't think is true in Europe. Or at least not true to the same extent.
And it wasn't substantiated in law, because if you look at the original, Immigration Act in 1790, and at least this awareness of sort of racial or ethnic balance existed all the way into the 1960s, with the Hart-Celler Act, when they started the mass migration. And again, I don't think it's just a coincidence that that law was passed the same during the Civil Rights era. And I do think there's been a concerted effort to break down heritage. America that finds its roots ultimately in European civilization, and a lot of benefits to that. And I don't see America that gets further removed or deracinated solely from its European roots. America retaining any semblance of what it is, freedom, the Constitution, these things. And this is, they talk about that. I said earlier, they talk about the changes that are going to come. And I always said that, ultimately when you're dealing with brute facts on the ground, is ultimately politics is ethnic warfare and demographics matter. And I can see the desire to say, listen, I understand ideas do matter, but ultimately you need numbers on your side. And how do you amass those numbers? How do you identify with one another? And is white identity becoming increasingly more legitimate identity when you deal with the enemies that we are now facing? And you've talked about this in this book, how the new right, unfortunately, your idea of the new right lacks a mature, cogent criticism, meaning we're just merely told we're racist, you're a fascist, and there's no real constructive criticism. And really, you do have the benefit. It does help you to have someone who's really willing to engage you and criticize you constructively, as opposed to trying to demonize you, because it makes you, I guess, sharpen your own ideas and thoughts and refine them in a way. And that's something that this new right doesn't have right now, because, again, to question democracy, to question radical equality, to question integration and constant mixing and change is to be a fascist, is to be a Nazi. And you can punch a Nazi, as CBS instructed us.
Right, exactly. No, you should punch a Nazi.
You should, right? Yes. It's
practically a civic duty at this point.
And everyone you disagree with is a Nazi.
Exactly. And so there's plenty of opportunities.
Yeah.
Right. So,
this is kind of the trap I'm in right now, or at least the, I don't know.
Well, and it's a very real and important question. It's doubtless to my mind that the idea of whiteness has produced a certain kind of breadth of alliances that might have been lacking otherwise. Which is to say, As a man of the new right, you can go to practically any corner of the West today, and if you find other individuals of the new right, you'll recognize them in some way. You'll be able to speak to them in a kind of very immediate way, right? I mean, you're not divided by the differences in nationality or the differences in language, as was once the case in Europe particularly. Mm-hmm. That cannot be anything but a good development for us. I mean, that is a necessary development for us.
I mean, didn't the Polish cavalry save Vienna from the Muslims? Then they ride in at the last, for my history, but I'm saying that the Poles are different.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that was one of the moments in which Europe actually managed to unite under a common banner against a common enemy and to expel this force, which was so un-European. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The only problem is our enemy today is, well, it's cosmopolitan. It's everywhere.
Exactly.
It's everywhere and it's nowhere.
And it's very dispersive, exactly. Yeah. It's all throughout society, at all levels of society. And this is part of the trouble with whiteness. I would put it this way. Whiteness, ethnicity, these things seem to me to be necessary conditions, but they're far from being sufficient conditions.
Yeah.
Which is clearly the case because our white societies, despite the fact that they were overwhelmingly white when these changes began to happen, were not defended against these changes. All of them have succumbed to one extent or another, some of them more than others. I think it's telling that the United States in a lot of ways is much worse off than most European nations. I won't say all, but most European nations, given that the United States is the place where, you can speak of whiteness with the greatest confidence, which suggests to me that there is something lacking there. There's something that perhaps we Americans never quite had. And this might be the result of our secularism. This might be the result of the fact that we've always had a kind of embattled relationship with old Europe and haven't really ever been able to stand on our own feet and to produce what could legitimately be called an American culture. Part of it is also due to the fact that our social conditions were absolutely oppositional, adversarial to that kind of a culture, because you cannot have a real culture, I believe, in a democracy like the United States. All of these are contributing factors, but the point stands that despite the fact that the United States was very much a white nation, it fell into the open, waiting arms of modernity with very little protest. And I think that this is why it's important to stress the European aspect, mm-hmm. perhaps even more than the white aspect, because even as Americans, we have that connection to Europe. It's obviously of a different kind than somebody who was born in Europe and grew up in Europe amidst all of European architecture, learning Europe firsthand and having that direct connection to European history. But nonetheless, we're Europeans in a certain important sense. And that European heritage might give us the beginning of what could transform potentially into a real ethos, a real way of being, which is our own and is capable of maintaining us against these gibbering waves of an encroaching modernity.
Yeah, that's the and if you do have European consciousness, identity, of course, European by default is white. If that means
right, anything. I think it's actually the original white, as it were, isn't it? It's whiteness as a notion disconnected from Europe doesn't mean a great deal to me. I'll put it that way. I think that there is a notion going today in certain circles that if you just collected a sufficient number of white people and got them into the middle of a desert or something and built a new city or society with all of these white people, they produce a society of a certain kind. I mean, Jonathan Bowden, for example, said that culture is race and race is culture. And I don't believe that that's true. I think that a race is something that has to be fulfilled in a certain sense. I mean, it's something that you have to work toward and consummate, and it can very easily fall into decadence.
It's very easy to see what's happened with American society, with the white majority. Why it's declining is falsely its corruption and its cultural decline. And so if culture was racial, then genetics would have ensured its perpetuation. It hasn't, because you can change the culture of a community or a society through various means of psychological warfare, with creation of suburbia, media, the economy itself, promoting drug use, the opioid crisis and these things, methamphetamine. So there's various ways, despite the genetics, you can corrupt the culture of that society without immediately changing its genetics. And then it comes the genetic transformation.
As we're saying. Right. You know,
over an attempt to destroy, you know, that's not, again, well, I guess identifying, taking pride in one's genetic expressions or how you look has become so pathologized, you know.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, why should that be? I mean, I was looking.
Right. Around. I mean, it shouldn't be. There's. I mean, as much as I despise this kind of multicultural liberal attitude that sort of wants to embrace all of the world's ways, et cetera, there is something to be said for the fact that the world, say, 200 or 300 years ago was much more aesthetically interesting.
Yes.
On the human level than it is today. There really was a kind of diversity that reigned in those days. You could go to different nations and encounter vastly different ways of dressing, of manners, of speech, of mores, et cetera, that today it's very difficult to find. You got to go to the distant corners of the world to find it and do some real voyaging. And certainly in the West, it's very difficult to find anything like that. We're all very homogenized in Europe and in the United States, obviously.
Yeah. So you have to look at the, you know, everywhere you go, you get to see the same stores now, you know, so.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And there's something to be said for that. Even from the aesthetic point of view, but also from the point of view of having that kind of potential of standing outside of your nation for a moment and seeing it from a different point of view. Which is something that we have lost to a large extent in the present contemporary world, because everywhere we go in the West, we're bound to be confronted with the same opinions. Whereas it was once the case that you could go on a tour of Europe and you might actually get some richness of view from it. Mm-hmm. And now it's all...
And none of this is natural, because the mixing is all...
Right.
It's all, you know, social engineering being paid for by various organizations.
Absolutely.
The people aren't walking. You know, I mean, people in Somalia aren't walking to Minnesota. They're being
there
flown.
There might be a few
in.
Impediments to that.
Yeah, you know. So it's just a social engineering on a grand scale. It's very disruptive. I was just looking at I interviewed Ralph Hauck recently, and he had an article just about the end of childhood friendship, long term friendship. This is a function of diverse schools. Kids no longer go to these schools, they're atomized. And, hey, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, sorry. So I cut out. And he in the article, he had a picture of a yearbook, and it's like, you know, it's a Tower of Babel. And just at the very least, why should a child be forced to navigate that?
Right.
Just to satisfy your social experiment, because you think it's enriching. It's not, it's atomizing. And this is how, talking about how the Zoomers a lot of them don't have lifetime, long-term friends, real friends. They're being atomized because, you know, they can't go out and play anymore because they live in a neighborhood. It may, at the best, it may be polite, but it isn't friendly because everyone's different. This is the reality of diversity. And so they repair to the internet or computer games, and they never develop friendships or have normal experience, what we would just consider a normal, healthy experience to your development, and they're completely atomized. And this is what it leads to, you know.
And the only solution that can be proposed for it is this kind of final homogenization to the point that these differences are completely eradicated. The very differences that these people originally claimed to be cherishing and preserving and attempting to make flourish in the world, they have to eliminate them. They have to get rid of them. We have to have a brown future where everybody... all these ethnic differences have been completely eradicated. People presumably will dress in a very similar fashion as well. They'll certainly think in a similar fashion. And all of us will live happily ever after under a single world government. I mean, it's just so inherently contradictory. They're able to make these claims with a perfectly straight face.
And destroy. And at the very least, if you just don't like the aesthetics, you shouldn't be, you know, that's a legitimate position.
It is a legitimate position. There's something. I mean, I don't see how anyone could claim that obviously people will claim this, but I don't see how anybody could defend the position that there's something wrong with a person who sees something just inherently beautiful about a blonde, blue-eyed person, just as there might be something inherently beautiful about, you know, a classically black African, I mean, yeah, or you know, a Chinaman or what have you, that these differences are not the sort of thing that one can just throw off lightly.
Yeah, you shouldn't go to Sweden and then see a bunch of people from Somalia walking around.
Right. Just as you
should.
You're
not a racist if you're disappointed.
Swedes walking around, right?
Yeah, you're not a racist if you're disappointed.
Right, exactly. Right.
You know, and surprise. You know, and again, there's nothing wrong with in-group preferences, and there's nothing wrong with having a community based on it, because those are functional communities. The idea, again, they're using the language of integration, diversity, equality to make those dysfunctional communities. That's the truth behind this, the covert warfare. The one thing that the vast majority of Americans have to understand, and the vast majority of the people of the world have to understand, is the reality of covert ethnic warfare, which isn't so covert anymore. You know, if you watch TV or watch the ads and all that, this is the reality. So if you're dealing with the reality of ethnic warfare, which was declared, has been declared many times, you know, Kudinov Kaligi plan, the authoritarian personality and these things. So there's a paper trail if you want evidence of this, because it is a strategy for the enslavement of mankind by destroying any ethnic roots or any cultural ethnic roots, because that's how you create this rootless, you know, class of consumers, which they've, you know, spent the several decades creating. But this is the end point of capitalism, I guess you could say, liberalism.
It is.
You know, so.
This is what we're bound together. Capitalism is just economic democracy, right?
Yeah, exactly. And where not only can you just consume anything you want, you can also be anything you want, in theory.
Right, exactly.
You know, and then the process, they even pervert the language, where you have to use pretend with pronouns and these things, or you know,
right.
Pass laws that put you in jail if you fine you.
Just so remarkable.
This is the liberal society. So at least in traditional society, medieval society, it wasn't assault on sanity.
Right, exactly.
So anyway, I mean, so anything else you want to comment on the book or anything? Have we covered it or?
No, I think we've covered a great many points in it. It's been a pleasure speaking with you as always, Tim. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you for coming back on. I'll wish you. Do you you going to celebrate Thanksgiving over there?
I tend to mix American traditions.
I was wondering about.
I've got a 6-year-old boy as well, and you know, I'd like him to have some sense of half of his heritage. So.
Yeah, America does have some fine traditions, although they're very relatively young.
It does.
Thanksgiving is one of them that I do enjoy, although it's thoroughly secular. You can always, you know, it's still nice to get together with family, and that's always a healthy thing to do.
And it's interestingly one of the holidays that's preserved itself best from this kind of cloying marketeerism, this kind of encroaching capitalism.
It's been bridged with Christmas, though, because that now.
Yeah, exactly.
Right after dinner. I remember I was driving back from my brother's house, you know, where we usually get together, because you know I come from a large family, and you know it's like 70, 80 people get together. But on the way back home at night, you see people lining up outside the Best Buy.
Oh no!
To get the deals, and literally the tents out.
These are the depressing images that I don't miss not seeing from the United States. So.
And then, of course, you have the Black Friday. The media always highlights the Black Friday riots. Have you ever watched?
Right.
I'm starting to think some of those are probably staged because they just want it to happen. But anyway, that's a whole other thing.
And there's always somebody gets trampled to death just to show our hierarchy of values in the modern world.
Yeah, that's the world they want. That's where they've created. So
exactly.
But you don't have to take part in it. I never go out shopping the day on Black Friday.
Nor have I. Stay far away from the
from that
the marketplace on that day.
So, well, listen. Thank you, John.
Tim, thank you.
That's
thank
John you Bruce Leonard. Of course, he is the editor-in-chief of Arctos Media. That's arctos.com.
That's it, arctos.com.
Where you get the books there, that's where you can get the book, The New Prometheans. I recommend it. It is a manifesto for the new right, a vision for the future. It's an excellent treatise on sort of our current situation. And I'll let you go and enjoy the remains of your weekend.
And you too, Tim. Thanks once more for your kind words and for having me on.